How do entrepreneurs actually implement the principles of Austrian economics? Let's start with consumer sovereignty. The question is, how do you make the customer your boss?
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are champions for customers, improving their lives with preferred products and services, value, and innovation. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We are going to try to get pretty specific in this podcast about how to implement Austrian economics in business by using a specific example and illustrating it with specific practice steps. We'll start at the beginning of the Austrian business paradigm with consumer sovereignty. In economics, that's a characteristic of the system. I've learned to call it a constraint. It means that what any firm in the economic system can successfully and profitably produce is constrained by the customer's decision to buy or not to buy. The customer's decision is binding, final, the ultimate authority. In the language of nation states, the customer is sovereign. The king, the queen, the czar. Today we use different language. Jeff Bezos of Amazon talks about customer obsession. Others use the term customer centricity, or customer first, or customer facing. It all derives from the Austrian economic principle of consumer sovereignty. And the customer can be tough. They'll reject your offering for their own reasons, no matter how many market research hoops you've jumped through. They'll change their minds without notice. They'll jump to a competitor's offering that they feel better meets their needs, even if you disagree. How do you please a sovereign consumer like this? A good way is to think of them as your boss. The boss's decision is always final. The boss is a human being and has personality and preferences and idiosyncratic behavioral traits. The boss has a limited amount of time, and it's hard to get his or her attention. She or he has a set of priorities which aren't the same as yours. But it's important that you know what they are. Having accepted your role in a system as someone who works for a boss, you try to get to know the boss as a person, as a decision maker, for example. Are they rational and logical, or emotional and impulsive? You might want to get to know the boss as a social person. Does she or he like sports? Which ones? That knowledge might help in a small talk situation before you pitch your idea. Do they like to travel? Where do they shop? What did they do last weekend? All of these pieces of information are useful in managing your relationship with the boss. You can transpose these considerations directly to your new boss as an entrepreneur, your customer. Get to know them in as many ways as you can, not just in a business relationship. Get to know them so that you can bond with them on an emotional dimension and not just a dollars and cents dimension. Put them in top position in your hierarchy of considerations, which is the place the boss always occupies. Think of all the ways you can do that. Can you get to know what they really want? Can you make your offering compelling to them? Our guest today is Martin Lunendonk. He's an entrepreneur's entrepreneur, turning concepts like consumer sovereignty into step-by-step action plans, models, and processes that individual entrepreneurs can easily learn and follow in a system where Martin and his team are always at your side in helping you to implement and to raise your performance, especially in generating revenue and making profit. We came across him at one of his several businesses, FounderJar.com, which we'll talk about a little bit today. And he and his business partner, Anastasia, are also supporters of our Economics for Business project. Martin, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hi, Hunter.
Well, it's great to have you here. You're one of our bridge builders between what we think of as economic theory and application of those theories to business, which is your area of expertise. We're going to start today talking about one of our concepts, consumer sovereignty, which is the idea that consumers decide what is produced, and they decide by buying or not buying, and that decides which producers, which companies are successful and which aren't. And it's kind of a procedural concept. The consumer is the end user, so the end user decides what the process of production is. And we talk about putting the consumer in first position in the company organization. But that's all easier said than done. It's a theory rather than a practice. You know a lot about putting this into practice, Martin. So how would you put the consumer or the customer in first position if you were running a company?
Yeah, it totally depends on the stage of your company. So, for example, if you are just starting out, you need to validate that you know exactly what is your target customer, what is the problem that you want to solve for him, how is your solution better than the alternatives, and you need to validate this from a customer point of view, and not only because you think, oh, that's a great idea. No, you need to get into the mind of the customer, really try to understand his beliefs, his emotional reactions, his customer journey. So what is he doing all the day? When is the problem occurring? And why can you solve it better? So not just saying, oh, I'm building the next Facebook. Oh, great. But what problem are you solving actually better? So, for example, solving something cheaper. We are doing the same stuff that anybody else is doing, but because we are using AI, we are doing this 70% cheaper. Okay, great. Or everybody else is doing this just by guesswork, but we have some really precise mathematical, statistical calculations behind that with a much higher accuracy and thereby reducing the risk for the consumer. Okay, cool. Or maybe you have something unique to offer. Everybody else is selling chocolate bars, and what are you selling? You are selling, I don't know, strawberry bar or something like this. So really, this is where you need to put the customer first when you're starting the business. Later on, when you are already a little bit ahead, have like the first 500,000 or million in revenue, then you need to also have a customer support where you have daily interactions with the customers, with complaints, etc. And then you also need to learn how people are using your product and what problems are then occurring with them. And maybe then feeding this type of feedback again back into your sales channels, into your production, into your logistic chains, etc. And then at some point, if you are really, really, really big, and you did your IPO and you are selling billions in dollars of products every year, then you also need to think about, okay, how can I change the mindset and mentality of my organization so that they become more customer focused? Because once you are onboarding new employees, you, of course, need to check and pre-select the right people. But sometimes, at least from my own experience, there are several employees who are not very customer-oriented. Because being customer-oriented is a specific type of mindset and taking the extra or going the extra mile in order to really, really understand what the customer is solving. So imagine a complaining customer is calling you at the customer support service and he is really screaming because he has some problem. This might be very stressful for you. And you could just say, okay, I will ask him 1, 2, 3 questions and that's it. Hopefully in 2 minutes, this is gone. Or you really try to dig deep into this and then take this information and not only in your silo, but spread it to the right points in your organization so that they can also put this into their function, like I said, in the marketing, sales, or production function. And this is what I would be highlighting. I think those are three good examples of putting the customer first.
Well, let me unpack a couple of things you mentioned, Martin. That's a lot of depth there. You said get inside the customer's mind.
Right.
And we have some ideas about that. But again, how do you do that practically? And as you mentioned, how do you do it at scale? Tell us how you advise companies to be able to do that.
Who at scale? I would put this aside because this is a much bigger issue. Because the question here would be, how do you replicate customer first type of mentality and so on? It's much harder. So I would rather start with me, because for me it's easier. But how to replicate what I'm doing into hundreds of other people? It's much harder because you lose. You lose, let's say, quality in terms of how you approach those things.
Okay, let's start with one.
Yeah. So when I'm thinking about starting a new business or something else, I'm first trying to really pin down what is the problem I want to solve for which type of audience. And I'm trying to be hyper specific. So not like, I want to help women, lose fat. Oh, this is not specific enough. Yeah. So if this would be my first hypothesis, which would be a dumb one, then I would first start talking to, let's say, 10, 20 women randomly, because I did not qualify them even more. And then I would really try to understand what type of issues do they have. Maybe some women will tell me, "Oh, I want to lose belly fat because I want to fit into the swimming suit." Okay, and so let's say 20%. Then another 10% would say, "Oh, I want to lose belly fat because I want to take part in a bodybuilder competition." Okay, good. Then maybe some others will say, "Oh, I want to lose belly fat because I just gave birth to 2 children." Okay, cool. And then I also maybe see some other patterns with means, for example, that maybe women between 45 to 55, those would rather lose fat because they want to stay healthy, live long, but don't want to work out like crazy. Okay, this is what I'm meaning by getting in the customer mindset, getting more contextual information and seeing patterns. Yeah, and you only get this if you are talking to different your potential clients and asking them relevant questions. Write down some of those structured answers. Try to identify patterns and then go deeper and deeper. Because what I've seen is most people and even most entrepreneurs, they are stopping at, let's say, question 5 or question 6. Yeah, and then they say, "Oh, okay, we understood enough." I would rather go the extra mile and go really, really deep, because my basic assumption for business is, might be wrong, but this is my worldview right now. If you know the customer better than he himself and your competitors, you can outcompete others, because you can calibrate your offering much better. You can calibrate your marketing and go-to-market strategy much better, just because you have a better customer intimacy. And you only get this if you go really, really deep. So in the end, after, let's say, 5 or 10 iterations, talking to different women and so on and so forth with different questions, you might end up with something like, "Oh, actually, I've identified a pattern. There are women between 45 and 55 who have a household income of at least $150,000 a year. They are living mainly in the urban area. Are high. Most of them have a bachelor's or a master's degree. Are typically white. Okay, and they are interested in art." And they are going to the gym 2 times a week for half an hour, doing this type of training. And this is the media that they are reading. For example, most of them are on, I don't know, reading TechCrunch or whatever media, which is really relevant to them. So I also know how to reach and communicate with them. And then maybe even have some kind of snippets. How many of them have children, if this is relevant, so in terms of how you structure. And also trying to understand, what is it that you actually want to solve? So because most of the time, customer will tell you, "Oh yeah, I want to lose belly fat." Is this really the problem that you're trying to solve? Because from my point of experience, there are several situations where customers told me, "Martin, I want to solve A," and then after some digging deeper, it's actually they want to solve C, but C leads to B and B leads often to A, but they are starting with A, and they don't see the deeper problem that they are actually trying to solve.
Yeah, there's a technique called 5 Whys that I was taught. Why is in WHY the question.
Yeah.
And you ask a customer, why did you act that way? Or why do you say what you just said? And then whatever they tell you, you ask, well, why? And the rule of thumb is you ask why five times, you get to that level of depth that you're talking about. That sounds a little bit like what you're talking about.
Yeah. Goes into the direction, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the opposite of conventional market research, Martin. Market research tries to impose those patterns that you talked about from the top down. It talks about segmentation and those kinds of things. Whereas you're saying, develop an individual profile of an individual consumer. You'll get lots of them. And you may be able to build up from the bottom some patterns out of those, but you do it individual by individual. That sounds like a very modern digital age technique that requires a lot of careful analysis.
I would say, I think the end result should be something like a macro view where you see, okay, we have, I don't know, five different customer segments with different preferences, et cetera, et cetera. But you still should start with a hypothesis how this might be looking like. So, for example, in this case with the women who want to lose belly fat, my first assumption would be maybe there's a customer segment of women 25 to 35 who want to lose belly fat because they want to go to the beach. Okay. And my assumption, again, would be they only want to spend maximum 60 minutes per week getting this result. Okay. And this is my start assumption. And then I will talk to individuals. And then I could adjust based on this kind of customer feedback. I could adjust my assumption of what customer segment I should be targeting. So that's why I'm saying I would not start just randomly talking to individuals. I would be starting with a hypothesis of what, based on my background knowledge, which I accumulated over the last X years. And then I would start talking to individuals and not just starting with talking to random individuals.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's Mises.org/E4E. POD, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Does this make sense?
Yep. And you mentioned we talked about scale, and you said, boy, that's really hard. But you did tell me one time that you can get your salespeople or customer service people or others on the front line who are talking to customers as part of their jobs, you can train them to dig out these kinds of pieces of data and ask these questions. Is that right?
So here's how I would do that. Because what I've seen in so many customer support organizations, they have some kind of metrics where they are measuring the quality and the value of their employees. Like, for example, the number of calls you have been taking over a period of time. So that if you're setting up this type of metrics, then of course, the customer support agent does not have time to go really, really deep. And also one thing, if this is the key metric and you only have, for example, 8 hours or whatsoever for a person to work on those things, they don't have maybe time to share this knowledge with the other stakeholders in the company. Here's how I would change that. Yeah, and this is by changing the metric system, because if you just measure how many calls did you get done in a week, in a day, then this is what people will optimize for. But if you tell, actually, I don't care about really how much calls you do, or it's not the only metric I'm looking at, then I would be also looking at Okay, what was the feedback of those customers? Was the problem really solved? Did you learn something which we could improve? Did you share those learnings with the relevant people? Did those relevant people implement solutions that were addressing those issues? Yeah, and you could thereby expand this metric system from only having, for simplicity, one or two metrics, number of calls and satisfaction of those calls, to those five or six metrics. This might be the first one. The second thing I would be trying to teach those customer support agents is really, really good listening and asking questions based on really being interested, because I've seen so many people in product and UX and so on working from what I would call a mediocre interest level. So just like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. But no, really, you want to really, really understand what the customer is doing, and you want to really get it really down, really deep. And most people don't do this. We need to find a way that helps people learn those kinds of skills and also allow them to ask them. Yeah. Those two things I would be implementing if I want to have a customer first organization in the customer support area.
Well, good. That's really helpful. And the next step in the process here, getting inside the customer's mind, understanding the customer and solving their problems, is to design a solution that actually does that. And that, again, is not an automatic process. What do you advise people on the design process once you think you have a good understanding of the problem to solve?
Yeah. And so the first thing I learned is really separate the problem from the solution space. So like you said, once you really understand the problem, when it occurs, how big it is, why it's happening, and so on and so forth, then you need to really be creative. So one thing is you need to define the key metrics that your solution should be fulfilling. Second, really being hardcore creative from the whole team, and maybe even some outsiders if they want, on how to improve those metrics. For example, if somebody says, I want to go as fast as possible from New York to Boston. Okay, if that's the problem, spend maximum $500 or so, yeah? And it should be safe. If those are the problem description, and you can translate this somehow in solution requirements, then you can be hardcore creative in your team and say, okay, what if we would be building a car sharing platform where we have multiple stops based on where people want to go, and we have some kind of people pay like they do with today's car sharing providers. And we also do this then, we fulfill those requirements. Okay, one. And you write down your hypothesis for those different solution requirements, like how much does it cost? How fast is it to go from New York to Boston? How convenient is it, etc.? And to this type of creative option. Another one might be, okay, what if we put a hyperloop in there? Okay. Oh, no, actually, it's too expensive. It's like $700, for example. Okay. And then you have like a long list of different options, which you then can say, okay, let's focus on the one or two most probable winners. And then you have only a hypothesis of a solution. Don't build anything, yeah, in this kind of stage. And then you do some kind of mock-ups, very super cheap testing, where you then go to the customers that you talked about with this problem and ask them, guys, we have some idea on how we could solve this problem, just to make sure that we really understand the problem. Is this the problem? Da-da-da-da-da? Yeah, it is. Okay, great. Here's here we have three options what you could do. You could either take this $700 Hyperloop in 2 hours there, or you take the this car sharing example, or we have genetically modified a horse which can run at 300 kilometers per hour. Option three. Okay, which, and then you see which of those options are preferred by your customers. Yeah, and you also see the feedback and the clarification questions that they are asking or the comments that they are making, and then you need to take this type of feedback into your next iteration, because maybe at some point they say, what about convenience? Because if I'm using or riding on this genetically high-speed horse, then I would need a helmet. Ah, okay. Actually, we did not think about this. Okay, we have more contextual information towards our how we calibrate the solution. Okay, and then you do this type of iterations 2, 3, 4 times until you have a good understanding of how the solution should look like, and then you can do a quantitative test. And then, because you, next time you go with your solution, let's assume the Hyperloop solution is the preferred one right now, and then you go with your specific product. Go again to 20-30 people who you of your target audience, and then say, okay, we have this kind of offer. You are in this type of situation. Do you want to buy this right now? I mean, no. Right now, you can book it if you want to go from Boston from New York to Boston. Just give us the PayPal email. Okay. And if they say, wow, if at least 40-50% say, yeah, here's my PayPal ID, for example, then you say, oh, we are onto something. Then you can do your business or for financial plan to see whether this financially makes sense, your business model or not. And then the next thing, again, you're still not building something. Then you can do, for example, just set up a website where you... You pitch again your Hyperloop solution. Wow, we have this great Hyperloop solution. It's only going from this 10 cities. You just select city from where to go and to which destination. And we will show you with a specific pitch. And here is how you can order it. And then you just have people order it by sending you money to PayPal or entering their credit card data. And then you once they do this, you just say, hey, sorry, we are still in development mode. Something got mixed up. Da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, because you did not build the expensive backend. And if you then still see, and then you pay some Google AdWords campaigns or something like this to drive traffic to your website, see how those people convert, how much your customer acquisition cost in this experiment is, just so you have more data for your financial model. And if then, again, people are more interested in what you are offering, let's say you see, oh, we only have like, 30, 40 euros customer acquisition cost, and those this cost, the travel cost like $700, and we are making $100 gross profit with that. Okay, cool. If we assume those customers will be returning, then the customer lifetime value is much, much bigger compared to the customer acquisition cost. Sounds like a cool business model. Okay, great. Let's invest $50,000 whatsoever in building up the backend so that it's actually working. Because right now, we were just testing whether we have found something that customers value. And now... We want to make sure that we are actually delivering the value. And that's why we're taking the 50K, for example, and investing in actually making this happen.
Yeah, that explains why Richard Branson was able to sell space travel for $1 million or whatever his price was for the individual who bought it. That will be sometime in the future, but he knows that initially he can get a price of $1 million. It's worth that to somebody. So, Martin, you mentioned some of the criteria that a customer might have with a new solution. You mentioned cost, speed, safety, convenience, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You introduced me also to another metric, which was an interesting way of thinking about the customer experience. You called it the customer effort score, which is about how hard it is for the customer to acquire the solution or experience the solution. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The cool thing is you can ask the customer, or you can actually just look at your analytics data to also get this. Because you also always need to think about how do you acquire the customer feedback. And you can either ask those customers with a survey or something like this, or this kind of a quick scoring like a net promoter score or what you just said, or you just look at the data of, 100 people signed up, and then 90% of those people left after 5 seconds. Oh, and you can also see what the people clicked. And then you can say, I think the people either don't get it or it's too complicated or they are missing something. I think we need to improve this type of metric in terms of the people who are activating, for example, and using your software relative to how many people registered. And this is also an indicator. So I would always try to, I would be first looking at patterns by looking at analytical data to get some bigger pictures. And if I want to have a very hyper-specific question, then I would be going for asking individuals, doing surveys, if it's a little bit more quantitative, or really talking to 10 or 20 or 50 individuals and getting really, really deep contextual information, which I can't if I just look at the analytics data.
Well, Martin, you've obviously got a huge expertise in customer and customer value and customer relationships and business economics in general. I mentioned your business partner, Anastasia. You have a company called FounderJar, which I've been enjoying finding about. But please tell us, what is FounderJar? What are you trying to do? How are you helping entrepreneurs? What is your goal?
Yeah. So before FounderJar, we started two other companies. And then we thought, in our today's world, it's not like you have a typically career and every 2, 3, 4 years, you are looking at a different job. It's my assumption is, over the next 5 to 10 years, more and more people will have a very, very strange CV or resume. For 2, 3, 4, 5 years, they will be employed, delivering value there. And then sometimes maybe for like 2, 3, 4 years, they will becoming self-employed, becoming a freelancer or starting their own business. And then maybe at some point they will selling the company or the company will go bust. And then they will be working again for some years as an employee. And then again, so more of this kind of switching between employee and entrepreneur. And what we do with FounderJar is helping people to really validate and select the business model that makes the most sense for them, then really build their audience and grow their audience and show them how to monetize them so that people not only go for the default option of putting advertising on their websites, but use some more, let's say, higher price tag monetization models like affiliate marketing, online courses, service offerings, or software products. And the thing is, our assumption is there's a space for tech startups, so people who say, oh, I want to build the new next cutting edge AI laser technology kind of stuff. And then they are raising $1 million for the seed round, building some nice MVP, getting the first traction. And then with 1%, they are selling the business for, let's say, 50 million or 100 million. Okay, this is the typically startup VC model, which we are not addressing. We are more addressing the larger market of the people who say, I'm fine building an online business which has 1 million or 5 or 10 million in revenue, but with a much higher probability to actually achieve it. And it's much easier to start. So I don't need to find investors and asking, begging, whatever, pitching for $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 just to get started and build my first great MVP and so on. Those business models that we describe can be easily started with $100, $200. But of course, you will need to invest maybe $10,000 or $20,000 to get really up to a point where you have great traction and earning good amount of ROI on your invested capital. Because this is the most important thing that what we look at. It doesn't matter how much money you invest into your startup. The question is, do you have the resources to get it started? And second question is, what is the probability and ROI of this? The probability of your success and the ROI and when you are successful. So if you, for example, investing $10,000, just for an example, into building up your blog, if this is the business model that you think is the makes the most sense for you and your lifestyle, and you have a probability of, let's say, 70% of creating $100,000 over the next 4 or 5 years, boom, then you have like a 70,000 cash return, which is basically a 7x multiple. And this is how we try to educate people how to think about this. Because what we saw, there are so many people who say, oh, I'm starting, for example, a blog, and I'm doing a little bit here and a little bit there, never get any traction. Because most of them have the wrong mindset. They are not thinking big enough. They are not thinking like an entrepreneur or a startup. They're just starting writing a little bit and that's it. But if you are really thinking like an entrepreneur and thinking about, okay, how can I build my target audience? How can I build, solve problems to this target audience? But not necessarily with the software, which is then the startup VC model, but just maybe starting with offering freelancing services or earning some money with recommending products of other people and earning affiliate marketing revenues, or saying, actually, I'm the expert on, not me, but just random guy, I'm the expert on how to lose belly fat. Okay, great. Then you can maybe productize this and sell this as an online course, for example. Or if you say, I'm such a great person with skincare. Okay, maybe you want to create your own skincare line and then set up an online store. And then we would be showing this to you on FounderJar. Those are the type of people we are and business models we are trying to target.
One of the things I've noted about FounderJar materials is that they're tremendously meticulous. They go into great detail about the specifics of what to do first, what to do second, check this, then you can go to the next step. What has your experience taught you about that kind of level of detail? Why is that so important, do you think, Martin?
So our assumption is like this. If you are new and somebody says, okay, just start an online shop and sell your skincare products. Okay, you feel lost, yeah, because you don't know, you don't have a plan or a map or something like this, or a blueprint which you could use. And what we are trying to do, and we share so much of our knowledge and insights in our hyper-long free blog post. Where we then show, okay, if you want to start your skincare program, first try to understand your target audience. Okay, and here's how you do this. This is how you segment your customers. This is how you interview them. Those are the tools that you can use to interview those people. Ah, okay, great. And this is how you use those tools. Okay, great. Okay, now I need to set up a shop. Which one shop is right? I don't know. Don't have a problem. We have an article which talks in detail about the 20 most common e-commerce platforms that you could choose with, and we tell for everyone for which use case this solution is most suited and why. And we also show you how to actually get your inventory onto those platforms, for example. And we also show you how to then do, for example, Facebook marketing in a step-by-step article, where we say, Facebook marketing is great, but actually, how do I set it up? Well, what things do I need to consider when I set up my campaign? I don't know. Maybe I need to look at the internet and read 50 different articles and then I have some idea. No, or you just read our 10, 15,000 word article and then you are 80% good to go. Yeah, so it's we don't have the aspiration to have all the knowledge on our side because this is clearly impossible. But we want to give people a roadmap on what things to think about, how to think about it, and be ready 80%. Because entrepreneurship is don't try to be a perfectionist. Try to get to 80% as fast as possible, boom, and then go to the next step, 80%, next step, 80%. Because in most businesses, except if you are building a nuclear power plant, you can redo most of the things, yeah? Especially if you are working on online businesses, that what we are doing. It's so easy to change a text, change articles, change design, layout, whatever, yeah? There are some things that you should be thinking about, but most things, it's rather speed and just starting. Yeah, because most people, they are overanalyzing and saying, oh, I first will analyze for 2 years whether this business model makes sense or not. Mm-hmm. Boom, business opportunity is gone because there's always a window of opportunity. And that's why the 80% rule in this case, from my point of view, makes the most sense because you're not spending 2 years for analyzing whether you should be going for this or not. You're spending maybe 3 months or 4 months getting down and then you are just starting. And then after 2 or 3 months, you already get the first good or bad feedback. I mean, good feedback for me is even if the customer is saying this shit, yeah? And then you are much faster because then after, for example, 4 months of really research, interviewing, etc., and then maybe 2 months building your first MVP platform, blog post, whatsoever, and then you already get feedback after in some 6 months. And then you have the next learning iteration. And then if you are continuing after the first 12 months, you are much, 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 much further ahead as if you just were putting the over-analyzing, I don't know, computer desk entrepreneur, yeah, who is actually not building something, but is just on the computer.
What is your monetization model, Martin? I've received lots of wonderful free stuff from FounderJar, and I get emails every day, and it's all terrific, and I haven't subscribed yet. I've just signed up for the email. So what is FounderJar's monetization plan?
Yeah. So right now, we are most of the stuff is not monetized because we run a finance club, which is a larger group with 1.2 million people on LinkedIn. We also run cleverism.com, our main business, which is a larger career website and job board in the US and UK. And then we started FounderJar 3 months ago. And right now we're not really monetizing. We have some little affiliate marketing in there. So if you, for example, would be using or choosing some of the products that we recommend, which from our point of view, those are only leading software tools, which we analyzed heavily and thereby can recommend, then we would earn a fee. But to no cost of to you, but in the future, we will be thinking about other monetization models as well, like for example, productizing our knowledge and experience into online courses.
Well, great. Well, I certainly recommend to anyone who's listening the FounderJar site. We'll put a link to it on our podcast notes page. Our key takeaways and. We'll highlight your other businesses too, Martin. So thank you very much for today. You've given us great insights and very, very practical, detailed ways to do things, which I think is your hallmark. So we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hunter. And guys, always try to put your customer and employees first.
Always good advice. Thanks, Martin.
Thanks.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.